When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody?
Hello, you are listening to the Quarter to Three movie podcast. Three of us here. I am Tom Chick. We also have with us Mr. Kelly Wand.
My last catchphrase tested poorly with the 18 to 52 demographic, so I have a new one this week.
Let's hear it.
It's, we're going to need a smaller shark.
That's, I like that. I'm quite fond of that.
See what I did there?
Let's run that by our third member here. We have Christian Minowski? It's a Polish thing, right?
I prefer to be called Rabbi Number Three.
Marshak.
Thank you, Christian Marshak.
Tom, that theme is a spoiler. You opened with a spoiler, an orchestral spoiler.
Well, let's real quick. So let's real quick just reiterate what this podcast is. This podcast is for people who have seen the movie we are going to discuss, and the movie that we're going to discuss this week is A Serious Man. The new Coen Brothers movie. So if you have not seen A Serious Man, stop listening. Actually, don't stop listening. Fast forward
to the 3x3.
3x3, exactly, our feature.
And that's the only part I think anyone actually listens to.
I think people will see these movies and then go back and listen to the discussion.
This is very frustrating because this is a movie we want to make people see, or at least I do. Maybe I'm in the minority.
Yeah, but that's not our job, though. Our job is to sort of parse it and sort of talk about it afterwards. That we're not
I don't think anyone's actually seen this one. And I think, by the way, did you notice Paranormal Activity was the number one movie in America right after we did a podcast about it?
Ah.
Coincidence?
Or, yeah, correlation could be causation, as they say.
It also kicked
in the Mythos
Project ass.
Well, that's like 2000 and what year was Blair? That's like $1998 or whatever.
Adjusting for inflation.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter.
Box
the ass
is so boring to talk about, but
it doesn't matter. The ass is the same throughout time.
Also a bit of business. We were supposed to be doing Gentleman Broncos. That's what we had announced at the end of last week. And I discovered that Gentleman Broncos was only playing in, I think, one theater in Los Angeles. So that couldn't have boded well for how easy it was going to be for people to see. If it's only in one theater in Los Angeles, so we decided to do. So it was only showing at it was only at one theater here in Los Angeles. So that couldn't have boded well for how widely it was playing, how many people would be able to see Gentleman Broncos. So we decided to opt for something that more people would be able to see, hence this week's Serious Man. And also, one of us who had seen it already was a big advocate for it already. And I believe that was you, Mr. Wand.
All right.
Yeah, you,
are we recording, by the way, right now?
Of course we're recording.
All right, that's my new catchphrase.
I liked your old one better.
Yeah, I did too. What was it?
It's
like an endless age ago.
We're going to need a smaller shark.
Right. That's good.
So, Kelly Wand, why did you want us to see this particular movie?
Oh, you guys didn't like it?
I'm not at liberty to say yet. I want to know why this was...
I thought it was the best movie I've seen this year.
An intriguing comment. Okay, so now have you seen more than three or four movies this year?
Not entirely. But
you can't include half movies.
Well, I saw both halves of this movie. And I thought it was the best zombie movie by the Coen brothers since Intolerable Cruelty.
I don't recall anything resembling a zombie in Intolerable Cruelty.
That was a George Clooney joke.
Ah, good. Good.
But see, notice that... Oh, never mind. That's a spoiler.
Well, like I was saying, we can spoil things. This is a podcast for people who have seen the movie.
Well,
And do you feel it's a spoiler to play Jefferson Airplane?
No, it's a good ad for the podcast, actually. And then people see the movie, they'll see why we played it. Because I predict they listen to this first and then go see the movie and just hopefully forget everything we're about to say.
Well, they're different.
But when I saw Where the Wild Things Are, I saw it there were kids in the audience, and I was studying what they were reacting to, and they're basically bored through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I saw A Serious Man in an audience of old Jews. Like,
me too!
Yeah, wasn't it awesome? And they were going, oy, like every scene.
It was like having a laugh track. It was so great.
And when they came out of it, and I was thinking, because the Coen brothers are on this like little streak where starting with the Perplexed Cowboys with No Country for Old Men, and then Cowboys with Burn After Reading. Now they're going to perplex Jews with this movie because it's like their third movie ending in a row where you can't believe that's the end of the movie. Spoiler alert!
I'm not getting your cowboys pun.
Oh, that, yeah, I don't know what that meant.
let's talk. Well, before we talk about.
Go ahead.
Well,
I wasn't sure who Burn After Reading was meant to perplex, but I don't.
One of the things that I really want to talk about, but a little bit further, I want to grill you a bit more on this, Mr. Wand, is the continuity between No Country for Old Men, Burn After Reading, and A Serious Man, because there's a lot to chew on there. So you guys saw it with Jews in the audience. Were they laughing a lot?
No, they were wincing and just making horrified noises, which was endlessly funny to me. And I think that's the point of the movie. Or I think that's the gist of the comedy, as it were.
My audience had a hard time understanding. When I saw it, a lot of people left. It was sort of
out of movies I've seen this year than like the last 10 years combined. They walked out of Watchmen. They walked out of Crank 2. They walked out of Where the Wild Things Are. And this is like the fourth or fifth movie I've seen this year.
Well, you haven't seen Where the Wild Things Are, so that doesn't qualify because you walked out.
Right.
My audience really didn't know, I think, what they were watching, and there was a lot of laughter there were a lot of people in the audience who thought it was sort of a comedy in a way that I don't think it really was a comedy. Those are the people who left. Is they were like, okay, this is wacky and funny, and then it started not being so funny, and they're like, this isn't what I signed up for, I'm leaving. They wanted like a Raising Arizona Coen Brothers movie. So Dingus, was that you saw it with old Jews as well?
Oh yeah. And, my odyssey was a little bit odd because I went to see it at, 4 o'clock today and it was sold out when I got there. So I snuck in, because I don't believe sold out ever means sold out. And it didn't. I stood there through it was easily 30 minutes of previews, and a couple of seats weren't filled, so I went and sat down, and it was a lot of older people, and as that whole opening story began, there was just a lot of laughter at things that I didn't necessarily get. And then as it went on,
uneasy laughter.
No, wasn't. It was laughter at specific sort of Yiddish moments or Yiddish-isms or however you want to say that. And I realized as we were going through that I was being given sort of an insight into what the Jewish people were going to laugh at or think was funny. And I think there was a little bit of the this is funny, but I'm hoping it'll be funnier kind of a thing. But I definitely got a sense that this group of people understood the movie in a different way that I did, and it helped me understand it better. I almost felt like a whole group had bought a block of tickets and showed up.
The local synagogue. It was a screening for the local synagogue, Dingus.
And Jews are snobs, I think, because when I saw Blazing Saddles when I was a kid, there's a part where Mel Brooks is the Indian chief and he shouts, "Lozengain!" And I saw it with a Jewish friend when I was like a little kid, like 10 years old, and he laughed hysterically at that, and I didn't know what it meant, and I go, "What was that?" And he goes, "Oh, you wouldn't get it. It's Jewish." I go, "No, come on, just tell me what it means in Goyim speak so I can enjoy the joke." And he goes, "It means good night, sweet prince." And I'm like, "What?" So the point is, they're just laughing because they get it, not because it's funny.
It's not just that. There's a lot of in jokes for them. And in fact, the very, very ending of the movie, the very ending of the credits, there's a joke for them. And a lot of them were standing around and they burst into laughter. And I'm like I'm just looking down at my notebook and writing notes. It's just the acknowledgements face. And they just burst into laughter, like 20 or 25 of them. And I had to look up to find out what they were laughing at.
Non-Jews would get that. I think non-Jews would get that one as well.
Of course they would if they were paying attention, but they specifically watched that and they were all just talking amongst themselves. It was really quite an enjoyable little moment.
All right, tell me what happened because I didn't see it.
Because you had walked out of the movie by that, as you were wont to do.
If I leave during the credits, then there will be something after the credits. But if I stay and – no, there's going to be something after the credits, like Cannonball Run 2.
So there was a scene after the credits of the tornado hitting his house.
Ah, Oh, that's good.
Stop.
Come on, Dingus. You could have totally wasted that off on him.
Cary Elwes goes, ha ha!
Oh.
No,
Kelly,
we totally, yeah. There was just a no Jews were harmed in the making of this film.
Live. Actually, that's terrible. That's a stupid ending. Only idiot would have fallen for that. That totally ruins the movie. But go on.
It was just that little line as the credits are crawling up at the very end about how it's a green movie and it's the Humane Society approves. There was just the line, "No Jews were harmed in the making of this film."
I saw that.
Oh, see, so
like
you did
25, 30 people were standing around or sitting around laughing, and they just were just delighted by that little line.
So they liked the movie, or did they just like that line and hate the movie, and that line redeemed a little bit?
I think they liked it. I don't think they understood everything, and they were very clear about that as they walked out.
Because my head shuffled out just stupefied, and I don't think they liked the movie, but I liked that they didn't like the movie for some reason.
I think I didn't really care for the "No Jews were harmed in the making of this film" because I didn't really want a joke. The ending is really brutal, I think. Yeah. I mean, I think the whole movie is brutal, and I was not in the mood for any Coen Brothers levity at that point. So I could have done. I wished I had.
Maybe that was for the squares, and they knew you knew it, and they knew you before the credits.
I should have.
Tom, you're a moralist, a theology student, or something. Or you look for messages in every movie. What do you see as the message of A Serious Man?
A Serious Man is, to me, the Coen brothers. For me, the image that I think encapsulates this movie is Uncle Arthur sitting at the edge of an empty pool crying about Hashem hasn't done shit for me. The movie is the equivalent of that.
Don't use that word, Arthur.
Very good.
A+.
I struggle with sort of how I feel about them making this movie. I mean, there's
this is their free ride movie. This is because they won the Oscar for No Country for Old Men. So their free ride movies are always the most interesting movies. You'll see.
Wasn't Burn After Reading sort of their free ride movie? Well, that was a big celebrity cast.
I think they're already done with that by the time the Oscars came out.
This
is the one they snuck in and went, hey, yeah, this only cost a couple million.
But as a sort of a theological message, I mean, this was very much this kind of, it was very much like Job. I mean, just sort of sitting there. Right. Sort of railing against the universe for not being fair. And I, as a message, see a lot of continuity with No Country for Old Men and, in a way, Burn After Reading. This is the movie that Burn After Reading, I think, should have been. And this is the movie that these guys made, I think, after having been, and I don't know, when I see a movie, I sort of sometimes want to puzzle out sort of the psychology of the people who made it. You know, what are they going through? And so part of me thinks this is the movie the Coen brothers made after reading Cormac McCarthy, after being heavily influenced by No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. And I think I told you once that I read McMurtry before McCarthy. Like mm-hmm. I read Lonesome Dove. And mm-hmm. I told you once the difference between them is Greg McMurtry thinks that we were at least once good, but now we're not. And Cormac McCarthy thinks we were never good.
Cormac McCarthy, I think, have you read The Road? I don't want to get too much into that, but
yeah,
so I think there's
that's
some
a happy ending book.
Right, exactly. There's some evolution going on there. I think he had a son. So that's, again, that's me sort of wanting to parse what's in the mind of a creative talent. But yes, I basically agree. And this is very much sort of Coen brothers by way of what they drew out of No Country for Old Men. And
I looked online to see if their parents had broken up, and I couldn't find any records.
Like if this was like a sort of a biographical story, right?
I mean, it feels very autobiographical.
Are they from the Midwest? Like, are they from Minnesota?
Yeah, they're from Michigan or something.
Okay.
But when the kid's sitting baked in his classroom, that to me was infinitely more faithful a representation of what it felt like to be 9 than anything in Where the Wild Things Are.
And
39.
Yeah, I don't think you get bar mitzvahed when you're 9, at least not in Indian.
Now I am a man!
So that's sort of what message did you guys get out of it?
I got three messages. One is don't get married. Two is don't have kids. And three is don't try to pay your dealer off during Torah lessons.
Okay.
Dingus, you? Okay. That's all I got.
Those are the same messages I got, actually. It's weird that you would say that.
I got that, and this is just where apparently fables and Jewish fables in particular, their point is always summed up at the very end, which I guess could be construed as, you know, Jews were harmed during this film. But the fact that the phone rings with bad news the second that the main character commits his sort of first immoral deed of the movie after he's just been tested over and over. Mm-hmm. I got out of that morally speaking, you're always on the clock no matter what you've been through. No matter how bad things are, you can't compromise your principles.
Yeah, it's not just that. It's that they don't – and you see so many parallels, you know, in the editing in this movie. It's that neither Lawrence nor Danny have learned anything, or the lessons they've taken are not the lessons they needed to take. There's just that great moment, and for me, the lesson of the movie is that one of the first things his wife says to him at the dinner table, which he's complaining about the neighbor mowing part of his lawn, and her response is, "Does that matter? Is it important?" And I just kept hearing that throughout the movie. Does that matter? Is it important?
Yeah. Well, most of the Coen brothers, there's like a theme about how the characters are always worried about money. Like that's the most important thing, but it winds up never being relevant. Like there's always a tornado on the horizon, makes the money meaningless.
And I love the gut punch of that image at the end. You know, I don't mean that in any way as a pun about the X-ray. It's just that tornado coming in as Dan. I think his name is Danny. He takes the money out and then tucks it back in as he sees the tornado. It's just such a punch in the gut.
Yeah. Well, the ending there is this sort of the sins of the father passed down to the son. I mean, there he is thinking that he's resolved everything. You know, by taking care of his financial situation. But once he sees that beyond that, there's something much worse coming down the horizon, and behind him is the person charged with protecting him and handing down his tradition and advising him, the person charged with that, ineffectually unable to open the door to sanctuary, you know, fumbling with the keys to get the kids into the basement, can't get them in.
Another dumbass old man, another dumb authority figure.
But that's,
has keys but doesn't know how to fit them into the mysteries of life.
And that's sort of what what's the father's name? I can't believe I just saw it too.
Lawrence.
Right. That's sort of his dilemma there as well. You know, he's turning to tradition, and these people who have been charged with advising him and bringing him up and preserving this tradition, and they can't let him into any sort of sanctuary. And they certainly don't protect him from cancer, and they ultimately have nothing to do with him resolving his financial problems. You know, that right there, I mean, just when the screen went black and I realized, wow, that's the image. It's like you're saying, Kelly, it's sort of the very last moment in a fable. You know, the punchline of the joke or the moral of the story, you know, that image of his son in the same situation that he was in at the end. I mean, that was the big gut punch to me. I mean, of course he's going to get cancer. The movie's all about these terrible things happening to him. But you sort of feel like, okay, you know, maybe his son is going to come out okay, and he gets his bar mitzvah.
Isn't he about to get hit by a tornado too? Like, isn't that about to hit Lawrence's office? And then that'll spare him the months and years of a slow death. So in a way, the tornado's a blessing for him.
Well,
necessarily, no. I don't see that.
Yeah, and I don't even think the tornado's going to necessarily hit the kid. I mean, that doesn't matter.
They're not in the same
building. It doesn't even matter if the tornado hits the kid. It's just the image of the tornado on the horizon. He's holding out the $20 to the bully. And then, you know, the bully turns around to face him. And he sees past the bully that, you know, none of that matters because here's this thing on the horizon. It reminds me of Ed Tom's final conversation with, I think it's his uncle at the end of No Country for Old Men, when he's told, I mean, it's sort of, again, the end of the movie sort of sums up the message. It's the moral of the story. He's told you can't face what's coming, or you can't see what's coming. There's that line, and you know, the penultimate scene in it's a little bit before that, in one of the last scenes in No Country for Old Men, where the guy says to him, you know, you can't see what's coming. You know, there's this sense that always something's going to be there.
Well, it's sort of a lesson of inevitability, and you know the very what's wonderful about that little fable at the beginning or that little story at the beginning is the last thing I think the wife says is good riddance to evil, and and there's no riddance to that. I mean, it's inevitable. It's just going to keep coming like a freight train or a tornado.
Right.
Yeah. Would it have come if she hadn't stabbed the old man?
Well. I think the point that I puzzled over that beginning. I'm still not sure I'm clear on it or where it fits in, but it seems to me the point of that is they are either cursed by a Dybbuk, you know, a ghost, or they're now guilty of murder. You know, one way or the other, this sense that the husband had done a good deed and the wife had brought her superstition into it, they're either murderers or they're cursed. You know,
if she knows that he's a Dybbuk, mm-hmm. let's assume that he is, doesn't she know how to kill a Dybbuk? Because her method doesn't work of the knitting needle through the heart. Like, are you up on Dybbuk lore?
I'm not up on my Dybbuk lore. I don't know. Yeah.
How come every time I ask you anything related about theology, you never know?
Well, you've asked me twice. Once was about demonology, and then now you're asking me about Dybbuks, about Yiddish demonology. So.
Is it all under the theological umbrella, though? I mean, is it all?
Well, he's closer to the Old Testament.
They can't all be right. Oh, right. So
you were all up in the Old Testament, so hello.
Well, what did you guys think of that opening? What did that do for you? How did that fit into the overall?
It made more sense after the movie was over. At the time, I was puzzled by it, and I heard the old Jews in the audience extremely puzzled by it, which made me feel a little better. And then I thought, well, I'll figure it out. I don't need to overhear their whispering. Figure out. Take that, Jewry.
Well, I tell you guys, Tom and Kelly, I'll say both of your names. For me, that opening clicks into place as soon as as soon as Lawrence has his conversation with the student, and he says those stories are not the point. They're just stories. The math is the point. I don't even know what that story about the cat means really. And I think that's what that story and the tooth story are. They're sort of like those stories aren't the point. We might not even know what those mean. The mathematics, the math is the point.
Right. Or where the Asian guy says, embrace the mystery. Isn't that one?
Yeah. He says something like that. Yeah.
I love that.
Please accept the mystery. I think is the actual.
Accept the mystery. And then Lawrence goes, what? Say it again. But I thought Lawrence was even more tested than Job, because when you read Job, as I know Tom did.
Nobody was more tested than Job. How dare you?
No. But he was at least told that he was the victim of the sadistic bet between the God he's worshiping and the devil. So at least he knows God exists and that he's at least a pawn in a bigger chess game. But Lawrence doesn't even know if that's true. He doesn't know if he's being tested. He has no reassurance.
And I didn't think much. I mean, you guys brought up the sense of like the – is there this sense, like, I came out of it thinking what an incredibly bleak, existential movie, you know, incredibly dark, you know, like I said, Uncle Arthur railing about Hashem has never done shit for me. But there is that sense, as soon as he erases the F and changes it to a C, and then and even gives it a minus, and then the phone rings, is this a movie about moral consequences? Is this movie set in a universe with moral consequences? Is there any sort of reassurance here?
Well, he survives his car accident, but Cy Abelman, who's a worse person, although he was wealthier, dies from his car accident the same instant. So maybe that was supposed to be his wake-up call, Lawrence's.
Do you see this?
Dodged a bullet.
Like, do you feel that this movie is saying? Do you feel that part of this movie is the idea that he finally fails a test, and therefore, you know, that's when God is going to give him cancer or whatever? Do you feel that there is moral consequence in the universe of this movie?
Well, he certainly proclaims that. He says it in those exact words, doesn't he? When he's sitting at the table in the second scene with the student, he actually slams his hand on the desk and says, there are consequences. There are consequences to everything. And I don't know if that's his image of it or if that's what the movie is trying to say. I think, again, the movie's just trying to say that life, evil, whatever label we want to put on it is inevitable. It's not necessarily a consequence of what we're doing. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
The odd thing is, though, that he has just gotten rewarded. He just got tenure for writing out this storm, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And then he So you think he's going to be kind of set financially because of the tenure. But then right after that, he changes the guy's grade for a measly, like, what, $3,000?
But again,
in response to the letter, like the bill for Uncle Arthur's legal fees.
Yeah. Okay. But if he hadn't gotten tenure, then that would have been an even more, I don't know.
Well, I don't believe, I got to say, I'm really happy. I'm sorry to stammer on, but I'm just discovering this now. I'm really happy, Tom, that you brought up this idea of consequences, because it doesn't seem that consequences are necessarily what's following from the actions, because Danny gets high in the bathroom before his bar mitzvah test, and then he stumbles up there and he looks like he's not going to succeed, and then he bursts through and he's wonderful and he passes it and snows them all. So
but getting stoned is a victimless crime.
Yeah. But he's done it, and the consequences of his you know, sort of cheating his way through his examination, he still passes through it.
Maybe it helps him study.
No, that's not what happens.
Oh.
Nice try, though.
But Dingus, do you really think, though, I don't think the movie looks disapprovingly at Danny getting stoned. I mean, it's not the same as the moral choice that Lawrence has to face with, do I accept the bribe? Do I hold this student accountable to the normal rules? Lawrence broke the law. Danny was just this kid getting high for an awesomely funny scene. I think that sort of captures childhood in a way.
That felt autobiographical.
That's a good point, because smoking pot isn't against the law. I forgot that. Good point.
Well, the law in the sense of the right and wrong of the movie, like of the law of, you know, tradition, morality, what's right, what's wrong. The movie doesn't, I don't feel, isn't at all judgmental about Danny getting high. I mean, his father gets high with the lady next door, who's smoking, by the way. I don't think that there's this sense that the son is doing anything wrong, in the same sense that the father is by changing the grade and accepting the money, is what I'm saying. I don't think that he didn't cheat, and he studied hard, by the way, for his bar mitzvah. You know, you saw him sitting there playing
the words.
He studied by listening to a record. That's how he listened to it. He didn't study the language and learn the language and learn the music. He cribbed from a record. Which,
well, how you get through a liturgy like that, though. I mean,
that's how they learn languages back in those days.
Well, he's in Hebrew school. I mean, like he's
he studied on his own time, but when he's in class, he listens to Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, he's stealing from his father. He's
that's a good point there.
He's
and actually, he's not stealing from his father. He's stealing from his sister, just to be clear.
She's using it on a nose job, so then he's going to a better cause than a nose job.
So here, I think, too, like, I'm also reluctant to, like, I don't really feel that the Coen brothers have pat messages so much as a sort of, they once described Barton Fink, like someone was asking him, what does Barton Fink mean? And I think they once, it's sort of hand-waving, but it's very appropriate and it fits. They sort of once said, Barton Fink doesn't mean anything, it's a state of mind. And so I sort of feel that way very much about this, about A Serious Man, is it's, and not necessarily, it's not as psychological or freaked out as Barton Fink. It's much more, I think it's sort of older and more mature. It's this sort of world view that they've...
It's because they read Cormac McCarthy, like you said.
Exactly. I think...
Yeah, it's Barton Fink plus Cormac McCarthy.
There was some wisdom imparted there. So I don't know that we can necessarily, like, I'm reluctant to try to pull pat messages from it.
You?
Well,
a theologian.
It's like I said. I mean, I don't think that's the kind of movie they're necessarily making. I mean, this is more of a weird sort of state of mind movie. And here's one of the things that I'd like to sort of talk about. I remember, I think it was Owen Gleiberman in Entertainment Weekly hating "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?" Yeah, no, Owen Gleiberman, he's a joke, but he hated "Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?" And he felt that it was mean to the characters, or that it was like cruel to the characters. They were making fun of the characters. That's what it was. He felt that the Coen brothers were mocking the characters, which I disagreed with. I think Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was very affectionate towards his characters. But there's definitely a sense in Burn After Reading and in A Serious Man, it's very brutal towards its characters.
It's brutal towards the dumb, too, in particular.
Well, but it's kind of, don't you feel it doesn't discriminate in its brutality, does it? It's brutal to everyone, and I'm wondering, how do you guys feel about that? Dingus, real quick, you've seen Burn After Reading, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we've all seen Burn After Reading. So how do you guys feel about that, and does it work? Does it feel any differently in Burn After Reading, or do you even see any relationship to the way it works in Burn After Reading and the way it works here?
Go ahead, Kelly.
I'll just make a short point because that's all I got. But in Burn After Reading, it's set in Washington, D.C., so I saw it as the dumbness of bureaucracy, and then this one would be the dumbness of suburbia.
Okay.
It's the dumbness of people. I mean, people are dumb in every city and in every era, and that's the Coen brothers' message, which I find quite profound and useful to know. Kids should study this movie.
And is there misanthropy there, do you think?
Yeah, but there should be. All right, now I'm sorry I cut you off. I think that's what we're going to say.
No, that's okay. I'm sort of thinking about that, and I'm having a hard time remembering so much about Burn After Reading because it made so little of an impression on me. But it seems to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that there was more caricature in that movie than in this film.
And that gets to sort of the heart of why I adored A Serious Man and really hated and thought was glib Burn After Reading. Is the characters in Burn After Reading were caricatures. They were cartoon characters who were then shot in the face and hacked up with hatchets.
But I think they were supposed to be. I think that's by design.
But it doesn't – sure,
I think it was
yeah.
meant to be a piffle. It was meant to, it's like a flavor.
But that doesn't speak to me in the same way.
Yeah, I don't get anything out of that any more than I get out of watching an anvil dropped on Wile E. Coyote's head. That just does nothing for me, really. And you're right, it's a trifle. But this has a very different, and I mean, this is similarly brutal to its characters, but these characters are much more human and relatable and authentic and sympathetic.
And plus, I felt like even though I don't know how to. Maybe I'm not going to get this across, but I felt like even though it was brutal towards characters, it still loved them. And I don't necessarily feel that about Burn After.
It loved some of them. I think it hated all of them but Lawrence and maybe Danny a little.
I think it had feelings for all of them and pitied some of them.
It did have feelings for Cy Abelman.
I was a little worried. Dingus. Like, I don't think Cy Abelman was a joke. The wife, I think, was kind of a joke.
We weren't meant to gravitate to the wife or hope things worked out for her.
There were definitely characters in here who were kind of like cartoon roles and weren't really fleshed out or didn't feel that human. And I was okay with them being brutalized or mocked. But it had characters in it that were nothing like Burn After Reading. You know, I mean, the guy playing Larry, who I looked him up, he's done a few things, but he's mainly a stage actor, Lawrence. He was phenomenal.
Yeah.
The guy was just,
it's a tough role too.
It's a tough role. And early on, I was like, okay, he's going to be like funny Jewish man. He's like the Jewish Jason Bateman and he's just goofing around. But it became much more of a, I mean, there was just so much like heart and authenticity there. It was he was really good.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why you like this movie and not Burn After Reading is because it had one relatable, sympathetic dude who was the eye of the tornado, as it were. In Burn After Reading, everyone was an idiot. Like John Malkovich wasn't supposed to be.
And that it feels very different to apply misanthropy to this fella than it does to the people in Burn After Reading.
But he doesn't feel misanthropy. He should.
Well, he's the subject of the Coen brothers' misanthropy. I mean, they put him in this story, and they put him through hell, and then right before the blackout, they give him cancer. And that's a terrible thing to do.
But it's good. It's entertaining to watch.
It is immensely entertaining, yeah.
Would you say this is the best movie you've seen this year?
I don't know.
Or do you rank movies like that?
No, I do, and we'll definitely be all doing our top 10 movies of the year podcast. But I'm not ready to say yet, but I certainly liked it, and it's certainly up there.
It reminded me, and this is really obscure and boring, so I'll just go through it as fast as I can, but it reminded me of this Graham Greene novel called The Heart of the Matter. which I had to read in college, so it's not like I'm that smart, but it's like the protagonist was this guy in some rubber plantation in Africa or something. Every tiny event in his life, he had like a rotten marriage and a rotten job, and every event was conspiring to convince him that the most practical thing for him to do was commit suicide. And at the end, he does. It's like the best thing for everyone but him. So he does it.
Wow.
And then Graham Greene commits suicide in RL. So
spoiler.
So read that book and enjoy that ending that I just ruined.
I don't think you're allowed to spoil books. Hello.
Yeah, I know. But the fact that I'm comparing it to this movie is a spoiler, because that implies that's... Never mind. Anyway.
I want to say one thing before we totally leave this thing that Tom brought up about I brought it up about caricatures, and he sort of more or less agreed with it. One thing that I got as I got to the end of it, there is one moment at the end of No Country for Old Men where I was like, oh, you guys slipped. At the very end, the mother is just this over the top. She's in the back of the cab, and she's the one actress in it who just is like from their younger days, who they picked, who's just a little over the top, and is the one sort of sour note for me. And I didn't feel like there was anybody in A Serious Man who was that. There was the kid who kept saying fuck him, but I didn't think there was anybody who was that over the top. What do you guys think?
Well, I think this movie's universe definitely supported, like, Beth Grant's character, and that woman's name, by the way, is Beth Grant, and she's awesome, and you're terrible for being mean to her, dingus, although I agree with you.
I feel awful.
I hope so.
She was doing kind of a Vicki Lawrence thing, I thought.
But there was no place for that in No Country for Old Men, which is otherwise everybody's very naturalistic in that. Yeah. There was no sort of
that's how that character is in the book.
No, it's not. It is so not.
The mom is. She's just like that.
She's not like Beth Grant pretending she's in Raising Arizona.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Raising Arizona.
But there's a lot of room for that in A Serious Man. From the various rabbis, you know, the young rabbi Dingus, didn't you feel like he would have been perfectly at home in Raising Arizona? You know, the rabbi talking about the parking lot.
Yeah, but he's constantly holding back. And I know where you're going for. And I kind of expected, is it Marshak? Is he the last one? I kind of expected him to be sort of a Woody Allen, like, get off my beard, old lady, you jerk, kind of a guy. And he turns out to be, you know, more subdued, and they're constantly more subdued than I'm expecting. They could have let go.
Are you talking about the old rabbi that recited Jefferson Airplane?
Yes.
What did you guys think of that part?
I had mixed feelings, but it was good. That's my mixed feeling.
It was just all part of that. Nobody has any answers, which is something Lawrence says to the guy who does the teeth story.
Right.
He just is exasperated and says, "Well, you don't seem to have any answers."
I saw just Marshak having listened to the tape and gone, "This is way better than anything the kid would have learned in that Torah class." So he's earned this back. What'd you get out of it, Tom?
I wasn't sure what to make of it. In a way, it's sort of like these religious traditions just tell us stuff we already know. And that's sort of what the kid, you know, he knows this is an awesome song, and he's been listening to it, and it just gets reiterated to him. You know, that's the thing, though, is they set up, you know, you see the rabbi back in the office. They set up that something is going to happen, and they can't really – I mean, they got out of that admirably. I thought it worked very well. If he had done some shtick like Dingus, like you were talking about, that would have disappointed me. If he had some answer, that would have disappointed me. But I thought it was a good callback. And by the way, I loved that song. And it's been used to great effect at various moments in various movies. Are you guys Cable Guy fans?
Yeah.
It's a great, you know, the scene where Jim Carrey's doing karaoke, and it's to that Jefferson Airplane song, is great in Cable Guy. It's this sort of anthem for alienation, I think.
And it sums up the plot of the movie, and it does in this one too, oddly. That's the sign of a good song, where it can be used in all these different movies of different genres and always fit.
Yeah.
And open the movie, and be the most memorable scene in the Cable. They remade the video because of the Cable Guy, didn't they do a Jim Carrey remix?
I would not be surprised. Yeah. And I love the, these guys, you know what? The Coen brothers with Roger Deakins as their DP and Carter Burwell soundtracks, they can just do whatever they want in perpetuity as far as I'm concerned. I just love seeing that sort of triumvirate. It's four of them, I guess. I just love seeing them work together. I loved the Carter Burwell soundtrack in this.
Are they all working on True Grit?
I don't know. I would hope so.
We're supposed to know this and inform people. ask each other.
And Tom, I'm going to throw in another name, and this is going to sound like a real dork thing to say, but there's this guy named Skip Leapsay. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but he does their sound. And I'm constantly struck by how great their sound is. Barton Fink has long been one of my favorite sound designs, and the sound in this movie is phenomenal, and he worked on it as well. And I saw his name, and I was like, I know his name. And so I went and looked him up, and he's worked on almost everything they've done. Just the sound design is phenomenal to me. There's this moment, just one example, that moment when he's on the roof and he's looking over at Miss what's her name, and she takes the cigarette to her mouth, and you hear the cigarette, her drawing in the breath. But there's no way you could hear that,
right?
But you hear
hears it.
That iconic sound of the cigarette and the burning. And there's constant sounds like that throughout the movie that I just love the way they design sound. And it's all a part of what you're talking about, Tom, about this team of people that just click so well together.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and God's enhancing his hearing to torture him more.
Well, it's like also like Uncle Arthur's like cyst draining machine. I mean, that was like something out of a David Cronenberg movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's the sickest sounding non-Cronenberg movie ever made.
That also makes me think of Job all of a sudden, because Job
and there's
because Job had those boils that he had to scrape off.
Yeah.
And his brother has it.
What else did Job go through besides boils? That's all I remember. What were the other trials of Job? Tom, you went to theology school, I believe. I don't know if this has come up in conversation yet, but debrief us on the Job story.
Job, he lost everything, didn't he? Like
he got boiled. He lost might have, his wealth.
He might have had a child or two spared, but
I think his wife dies too. Yeah, which in this case would have been a blessing, like Lawrence's wife. If she died, it would have solved.
But yeah, Job loses everything. I don't think he gets anything. I think he does come out with like maybe a couple of surviving kids, and that's it. But he never doesn't Job. I don't think he ever curses God and dies, though. Like, that's sort of the thing that he's challenged, you know, just curse God and die.
Lawrence didn't curse God either.
They're making their movies. These are secular people. You know, Lawrence isn't really turning to God so much as he's turning to tradition. And nobody these days turns to God. I mean, that's just not something you really get in a movie anymore. Because God isn't part of the equation. You know, this guy, I love the fact, you know, he's a mathematician or a physics teacher or whatever. You know, God's just not, you know, he can't curse God because he's not into God. That's not his deal.
So what can he get out of any of the rabbis then? Like, why does he think any of them can help him? Are rabbis actually wise? Because in the movies, I can't.
I mean, I think that's something that's sort of uniquely Jewish, is this idea that you're part of a religious tradition without necessarily being religious.
Priests are supposed to be wise, too.
But how many people, like there are plenty of non-practicing, you know, like if you're Catholic, like you tend to be practicing. Like you don't, there are all kinds of non-practicing Jews who are still every bit as much Jewish. Like Judaism is a cultural identity as much as a religious identity. And that's not really something that the Catholics have. If you go to a Catholic priest, it's probably because you're an observant Catholic.
Tom, I think he's trying to turn to God. I have to disagree with what you just said. He's desperately trying to find answers, and he's going to these men saying, does Hashem have these answers for me? What does he want? Does he want this of my life? Does he want me to help people? What does he want? I think he's trying to make that turn, and none of them are sincere enough or have the answers to help him.
I think you're both right, and he wants either one. He'll take anything he can get, and he can't get either secular or.
I think he sincerely wants a change, and if this is and if God can provide it for him, then he'll go for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? You're right, Dingus. I mean, because Hashem is very much a character in the movie. I mean, that definitely does make sense. Yeah. I mean, he definitely does. They talk about God, and even if he's not an observant Jew, I mean, I don't get the sense that they go to the synagogue every week or they observe Sabbath, and I don't get the sense that they're keeping kosher. But you're right. Like, I do like how Hashem is very much a character, and they talk about Hashem and Uncle Arthur's reaction. So, yeah, I will recant from that.
So there's no name for a wise old atheist you can go see who dispenses wisdom.
Yes, that's a therapist.
Unfiltered. That's the same thing. That's just jargon.
Bravo. That was nice, Tom.
Yeah, it was.
So Dingus, Kelly and I have both professed our love for this movie. Are you with us? Where does this fit in for you?
I certainly was delighted with it. I'm not prepared to tell you whether it was my favorite film of the year or no. Well, I can tell you it's not number one for me so far. It has not unseated what is so far number one. Not that I've
Transformers.
Transformers 2. What are
Transformers
you
2? Sorry.
How dare you? Risen.
Revenge of the Fallen.
Oh,
Fall of the Risen. That's awesome. You know, and by the way, at the end of the year, it's not going to be I'm not going to give you a list of the best film because I have no way of telling you what that is, but I'll give you my list of my favorite film. I loved this. I just saw it a couple hours ago and it's still sort of compiling. You know, I'm still compiling on it. Yeah. And every 15 minutes or so, some new thing sort of burbles up and I go, oh, wow, that's so it might be a little while for me on this. But so far I loved it. I'm not going to give it number one right now, I don't even know if it'll fit. But it did a whole lot for me. There's a lot of stuff to talk about.
There was some beautiful, I was so glad to see this because having not liked Burn After Reading, having felt like Burn After Reading was just this sort of misanthropic tripe, which was largely artless.
Why are you had misanthropy hater?
You know, there's a place for misanthropy, and you know, when it's done well, I'm all for it. But when it's just sort of sneering at characters you've written, I'm like, I don't need that. And Burn After Reading individually is made up of some wonderful, well done scenes. So at least it's artful misanthropic tripe. But I was so glad to see this movie is sort of reasserting how perceptive and how artful they can be as a whole. And one of the things I really loved about A Serious Man is some of the wordplay and sort of even the poetry in the script. And I'm thinking of two specific things. The moment I talked about where Arthur is at the edge of the pool saying Hashem hasn't done shit for me. I mean, that just sound, the sound shit and Hashem, you know, they play with that. I mean, that's clearly this great bit of wordplay they've got going. And by the way, Hashem, and Dingus, this sort of plays in what, you know, me saying that, that Lawrence is godless. I am backing off of that. So Hashem is the way that Jews talk about God. Adonai is what they use in the liturgy. And when they're not in a formal situation, they call him Hashem, and it just means the name. So it's this sort of informal colloquial way to talk about God when you're not being observant or particularly reverent.
So God's street name.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see.
And then the other bit, which I thought was brilliant for how they built it in there and how it was handled, is when he's talking to the Korean student who reminded me a bit of this sort of weird guest starring Asian character, kind of like the guy in Fargo who proclaims his love for Frances McDormand. What?
Well, that was his father.
Yes.
That's what I'm thinking is, yeah.
That's not the same actor, was it?
Yeah, that actor was his father.
Oh, no, it wasn't. Are you serious?
Oh,
the
yes,
guy who played
was.
The father, yes. The guy who was from Fargo?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm not going to – I haven't looked it up, but
Dingus,
how do you know that for sure? Or where are you basing that on? Because I thought the guy in Fargo was kind of chubby for some reason.
I'm almost positive it's the same guy.
Dingus, you are treading dangerously on some sort of like all Asians look alike territory. I'm not very comfortable with this. You need to check your work, young man.
You just said proclaims, so
if he's
don't
right,
get on me.
Yeah. that's true.
But anyway, so there's a moment where he's talking to Lawrence, and I'm going to screw this up. He says, and Lawrence is saying, you left this money. And he's saying, no, I didn't. You don't know that for a fact. And he says something that sounds like it's some ancient Korean tradition.
Genghis
he says
is
something
right.
Like
Genghis is right.
He says something like mere surmising.
Yeah.
And he's like, what? And I was expecting that he's going to explain it's the Korean word for honor, but you realize he's just said mere surmising. I mean, he's actually just said a perfectly good English phrase that's just them being very playful, I thought. So Kelly, you did just look up and you did,
His name's Stephen Park and he was in it. So
that's right. That's right. Cause Park is the last name of the character. Yeah. That's why I keyed on it.
Yeah. Yeah, well done, Dingus.
You know, Tom, what's wonderful, now that I'm sort of replaying both of those things, the pool scene and the scenes with the student, is there is this wonderful call and response sort of rhythm to those scenes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That whole, you know, Hashem hasn't done shit. Arthur, don't use that word. Hashem hasn't done shit for me. And some of the stuff with the student as well. I know what I left. I didn't know.
Yes.
I didn't know what you did. I know what I did, but you don't know. There's this real sort of bump, ba bump, ba bump, ba bump thing.
Yeah. And I don't recall any of that sort of playfulness in Burn After Reading, which was all very Ocean's 11 and let's get famous people and goof around, you know. And this, by the way, another thing I loved about A Serious Man, I love watching a movie where I'm not going to be recognizing actors. I mean, a couple of the people I'd seen before, character actors, but I loved the fact that during the opening credits, I was like, who is that? Who? What? Who? I didn't see a name in there I recognized. And I love that.
Yeah, it adds a sense of place.
Yep, exactly. It doesn't take you out of it into Los Angeles, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing they found that location too, because you get this awesome panoramic view of it when he's up goofing around with the antenna.
Because I have
and
to.
It looks amazingly bleak well, and.
Yeah, well, Kelly, I wonder, did they? How much of that is CG? Because it is. It's such a great period. Neighborhood.
I read they found a place that it's still like that,
and they didn't have to CG out a bunch of direct TV dishes or whatnot.
That's what I was wondering too, or like some tower in the background.
Yeah, it's like a golf course. It's like living on a golf course.
Well, I just loved even if you're looking down the street that there's no sidewalks.
Right.
There's just so many little touches.
That's what it is. Yeah, I was like, what's that looks
what's that
weird.
What
is
what's that a synonym? What's that an allegory for?
Very,
sidewalks.
Yeah, how about that?
Huh.
Yeah, I'm imagining it now because it wasn't just that the houses were flat and the expanse of lawns. You're
so
right.
No one walks anymore. There's no pedestrians. So it just checks 1138.
Well, they all walk in the street and
get hit and die in car accidents.
Or the drug dealer chases him down the street every day.
The streets are dangerous, and there's nothing between you and the street. You think you're in the grass, but you could get run over on the grass, too. That's the moral of the movie.
Or we don't understand the danger yet. I don't know.
And they probably just CG'd out the sidewalks.
Yeah.
I noticed that so they had gravel drives. And do you guys remember another Coen Brothers movie where a character is approached about paving his driveway? It's a little obscure trivia. So I was wondering, is that going to come up? They've got a gravel drive. Is Christopher McDonald going to come up and offer to pave their driveway?
Oh. Requiem for a Dream.
Transformers?
And, Christopher McDonald has – it's the only scene, and it's a very brief scene.
Miller's Crossing.
He comes up to Billy Bob Thornton and is Frances McDormand his wife in that? No, who plays his wife?
No,
in
his wife
there?
Is – she is the wife, and she gets killed off. I think.
Yeah, and she comes out and chases off Christopher McDonald as the driveway salesman.
Yeah.
So. Dingus, you were asking me last night about Man Who Wasn't There. Was that anything in relation to – A Serious Man?
It was just one of the things I wanted to see before I saw this, because it was one of their films that didn't hitch with me, and I wanted to see a couple of those. But you know, this week I kind of want to watch a few films every week that deal with what we're watching, so I can sort of get some background. And that one didn't really hook into it, and I wanted to see it again.
Right.
I didn't have any idea that A Serious Man was going to be this kind of period piece, so I had no idea if the two would hook up. I just wanted to get, you know, because I kind of tend to think if I didn't like something of theirs, my first inclination is maybe I missed the point.
I think and you
so,
did.
I think you did.
How was Man Who Wasn't There on review?
Well, I didn't get to see it, so.
Oh. I thought the whole point of that story was that you'd seen all these movies and you were the professional podcaster who actually researches his topic.
No, the point was
you didn't watch it, did you?
No, I didn't. Yeah, see?
Yeah, see?
But so we all agree on this one, A Fine Return to Form. Would you say it's, I think we would agree, it's one of their best movies. Or one of their, I'm reluctant to say best, but you know what, I'm going to. I would say it's one of their best movies.
I can't think of a better movie where I thought it was possibly the best movie they'd made this soon after seeing it.
Because part of No Country for Old Men is brilliant, but I have to lay a lot of that brilliance at Cormac McCarthy's feet. I mean, the fact that they wrote this. They generally do their own material anyway. But I don't know. You know what? I couldn't talking about your best, the best Coen or your favorite Coen Brothers movie. That's something that varies by, you know, time of day. At any given day, I can think that there are three different best Coen Brothers movies based on, you know, what I had for lunch or what time I got up or what mood I'm in.
I remember not thinking Fargo was all that when I first saw it.
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going to put this as their best movie. If during his dream of having sex with the neighbor, she had been topless, okay, you got me.
You already saw her topless. What do you want?
But during his dream, why isn't she topless? Hello?
Because he's pure.
Cause he's repressed.
Yeah, exactly. Like you.
Screw that. He's already seen her breasts. We've seen them from far away. They're pretty good. Go ahead. He's going to go ahead and have a dream about it. Let's go the full Monty. But no, instead she's bored.
I think
he can't even wet dream correctly.
And I'm in jest here, but I think that is beautiful when she's doing that bored act, and I'm thinking, oh, this cliche, really? She's bored having sex with him, and there's a number of these just dreams, and by the end of the film, you start to worry and think what's real and what isn't, and I love that.
Yeah.
Well, the dreams get get harsher and creepier as the movie goes on, and I think that's a sign. It's all deliberate. It's not just a. I don't know. It's not just one dream sequence after another.
Yeah.
No, but there's a sense that we don't know and he doesn't know. When he wakes up from the dream of taking his brother to Canada and he looks at him and says, were we at the pool last night? Or something like that. It was just this great moment of he doesn't know either.
Well, maybe the tornado's a dream.
Well, you know, you have to sort
of... the credits are a dream.
You have to think that. Except I don't think he's dreamed about anybody else and we're pretty much with him. I don't know that anybody – have we had anybody else's dreams in the movie? Or is it just his dreams?
It's just his.
Yeah. So, nice try.
Almost the whole movie's history.
Oh, no.
Well, so, Kelly, I was very glad you insisted we see that. I mean, I would have eventually seen it, but –
This was the only way I knew I could make you see it because you never listen to me. And that's, then years afterwards, you go, oh, yeah, man, The Office. Yeah,
first of all,
the American version.
First of all, that's not true that I never listen to you. The only time I haven't – you're just bitter because I never read that copy of Lonesome Dove that you loaned me.
I tried to read that, too, and I couldn't do it either.
Did you watch the – never mind.
Kelly, I did read, though, and you get credit for this, Outer Dark, which has that whole sense of – this terrible force on the horizon. I mean, I think Outer Dark is sort of the antecedent for Anton Chigurh, who in this movie is sort of personified as this tornado or cancer, depending on how you look at it. I think all of that goes back to Outer Dark, the sort of the vampire posse traveling around the Old West.
Yeah, there's three of them. There's three Anton Chigurhs.
Exactly. That's pretty obscure. From that obscure reference... How about a little Britney Spears?
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 degrees, and I'm caught in between, counting 1, 2, 3, Peter Pan, they're free, getting down with 3 to P,
everybody.
That's always my favorite part of this. Right there.
So Kelly, over to you. This is your bag this week.
Hold on. Sorry, I was just going to ask, do we have to explain it every time?
Well, Kelly, take it away. It's Kelly's bag this week.
I'll just do it really fast so no one – it's movies that suck until the final few minutes, and then somehow the ending is so good that it makes the whole movie seem good to you.
Kelly, explain this segment just because this is only our third podcast. What is it that we're doing here?
We're just naming three movies based on a topic, and no one wins anything. Is that right?
No one wins anything.
Dumb to me. I think someone should get something out of it.
Well, once
not us, but the listeners should somehow.
Right. Once you finish your student film, then people can win a copy of that. But this is our 3x3 segment.
Maybe if we have the same one, maybe something bad. We have to like drink boogers or something.
Kelly, first of all. Yeah, I didn't need that image. Second of all, you suck at introducing segments.
I wasn't prepared for this.
All you got to say is, okay, this is 3x3. Oh. The previous week we have introduced the topic, and this week we spent the week thinking of the movies. Now we're gonna lay them out.
Well, didn't I do that though?
Kind of. But you sort of jumped in.
I said what the topic was, and then obviously it's three because they heard the Britney Spears thing.
Okay. So that was your topic from last week, is movies that were sort of redeemed by their final moments. And do you want to start us off with your third?
Yeah.
Do you want someone else?
I'll start.
Okay.
I found this a very challenging list because most movies have crappy endings, and somehow I thought it would be fun to flip-flop your thing, and then it just wound up taking like all week to even come up with three.
It was a tough one. It was a very difficult one.
I won't be doing this again. Because it won't prompt any discussion on the boards, because no one's going to be able to think of any, right?
I came up with a great one. Of my three, only one of them I really love. I was kind of having to force it with a couple of them.
All right, well, you start then, because now I'm...
I'll start.
Well, you should have to start, because when you had the topic last week, you had
good
to
point.
Start first.
Fair enough. Okay. So my third one, and this is the one that I think is the toughest, because I didn't hate this movie. I mean, I think the idea is it's a movie you don't like until the end.
Right.
Have you guys seen Babel? The thing by I've never had to say their names out loud, so apologies to any Spanish speakers. The movie by Iñárritu and
I liked it.
Arriaga.
Like that movie?
Is it like the movie Babel?
Wait, there's a naked Asian girl in it way before the ending, so I don't know what you're talking.
Well, the thing, my problem with Babel, there's this immense sense of dread throughout the movie, and they're so good at just sort of giving you, it sort of conveying this crushing dread as you're watching it. And there are all of these kind of red herrings where a character has a gun, or a child is left behind, or a distraught person is on the ledge of a skyscraper, and you're like, oh God, this is going to be one of those movies where terrible things happen to the characters, and then it's different storylines, and they all come together. It's going to be like a more artsy version of Crash or something. But what I eventually loved about Babel is that it didn't do that. All of these things that you dread do not come to pass, and I respected the movie much more in retrospect once I realized they weren't going for that sort of cheap, let's Hamlet ending, where let's just kill everyone off and leave the audience with this sort of emotional sucker punch. So there you go. So Babel, that's my number three pick for a movie.
That's
that,
a very odd. Okay, I don't.
Well, this was a tough topic. You put me backed me into a corner here, Kelly.
Mine sucked too. Because you didn't actually describe what the ending was, except...
Well, the ending wasn't, exactly. Yeah.
I see.
So, I'm forcing it. I had a tough time with this.
That's a whole different list.
Well, I know. It gets better. My number one pick is awesome.
Oh, that's not the good one.
I love you for my number one pick, the first one, the one that I came up with. So, Dingus, what's your number three?
I had just as much of a tough time, and I broke the category as well. What I ended up doing is having to settle for movies that I basically felt like I didn't get until sometime near the end.
Is that the topic?
I didn't like it until the movie finally clicked for me in the last several minutes or whatever.
Okay.
So it's not the topic, but yeah, it's Star Wars, 2001, I think there's another, and Sunshine. Those are my, did I give all three?
Yeah.
All right. Number three, this is I'm going to totally suck on this, but I'll be this week's Tom, I guess. First, I'm going to start with one of my friend's movies that he didn't like. No, I'm just kidding. Number three is The International, which I really did not like.
Until we got to this
great sequence in the Guggenheim, and then this great running across rooftops in Turkey, I think it was. And this whole running, there's this whole sequence where one guy's chasing another guy across these rooftops in Turkey. And it looked like this FPS level. And I just said, okay, I like it just fine. So
what?
That's
my that my reaction that's is the same as Kelly's. What?
That's why you like, that's, wow.
Yeah,
I'm feeling better about my list all the time.
Yeah, you're gonna hate it.
So. Kind of like the list. It's the perfect. This list is like the topic.
Yeah, you're gonna continue to feel better about yourself as we go on. So go ahead, Kelly.
Wow.
What's your number three, Kelly?
I wanted to say Planet of the Apes, Tim Burton's, because I like that really stupid ending, even though he doesn't get it either. But I consider it like the Abe Lincoln ending of Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. Like,
wait, did they do it? Did they do the damn you to hell, you really did it, you blew it all up? Did they do that at the end of the Tim Burton one?
You didn't see it?
No, good Lord, why would I see that?
He goes
wait a
back,
minute. Kelly, that's this weird. Isn't your number three. This is what you wanted to be number three?
All right. Well, because my number three is a little obscure. It's,
you're such a cheater!
Yeah, this is not 3x4 or 4x3, Kelly. This is 3x3.
You're right, I suck. And I
1, 2, 3, not only you and me, got 180 to 3.
In case you were unclear about the number that we're dealing with.
I wasn't listening to you when you described it, because I was listening to Jefferson Airplane. I mean, Britney Spears.
All right, so what's your number three?
My number three, this is the most obscure one. It's this Australian Last Man on Earth movie. Even though there's yet to be a Last Man on Earth movie where they're actually the last man on Earth. But this one's called The Quiet Earth.
Oh, that's not that obscure. Everybody knows Quiet Earth. I don't remember what happened at the end, though. Yeah, of course.
And it's New Zealand. Good God.
Oh, that sucks. I'm embarrassed.
New Zealand, Dingus, is just a province in Australia. That's like trying to pretend that Hawaii isn't in the U.S. Jeez.
They're just migrants anyway. New Zealand's the Mexico of Australia.
Oh, nice.
Everyone knows it. Snap. Take that, Kiwis.
So what happens at the end of Quiet Earth that redeems the movie that you didn't like the movie while you're watching it and then...
Okay. Dingus may correct me if I'm wrong, but as I recall, the reason he's the last man on Earth or thinks he is for about 20 minutes of the movie in the Quiet Earth is because some scientific device went off, and so everyone who wasn't asleep or unconscious, it's kind of a ripoff of the Langoliers, even though the Langoliers came later.
How did it rip
but
off?
But then at the end, mm-hmm. there's going to be some, it's going to happen again. There's going to be some other event, and they're all going to die too. And then he does some noble sacrifice and prevents it, and then he drives a truck into a refinery, something scientific. And then he wakes up and he's on this beach on this other planet. And there's like this glass structure in the background. Oh, it's so good. Okay, go.
I don't think you – that made no sense. I have no idea what was going on there.
If you see the movie, though, you go, oh, he described it perfectly. That was quite eloquent.
All right. Okay.
Does quite the film critic.
Does my headset register just shaking my head sadly?
No, yeah. You have to vocalize somehow. Give
you
us
know
a little
what? It's been 20 years since I've seen it, and I didn't realize I'd have to actually remember it to do.
All right, well, I'm going to go on to my number two. My number two is a movie that I still hate. I think it's a terrible movie, but something happens in the end of the movie where I was like, you know what? This could have been a good script.
Okay, that's not the category either.
Yeah. No. I hated the movie, but then something happens at the end where going back, I was like, okay, I can see things in this movie could have been good. I could have liked this movie if it wasn't bad, but it was already bad. So, did any of you guys see The Happening, the M. Night Shyamalan movie?
No, I had it described for me by a friend.
Well, the idea of The Happening is the scientific mumbo jumbo that they explain to sort of explain what's going on in The Happening, that screws it up.
They didn't have any of that. They didn't even describe what was going on scientifically. And he's a science teacher.
No,
he
scientific,
had no curiosity about what was going on.
Scientifically, plants on Earth feel they're being threatened by the human population, so they generate a neurotoxin that causes human beings to commit suicide.
Including the trees in Central Park that we maintain and are alive because of human intervention.
And the way that the neurotoxin works is it only affects human beings when they're densely populated enough to threaten the plant life. So that's
the
stupid
calls for it.
So that's the stupid sort of scientific explanation for what's going on. But what they do at the end of the movie is he's running around with his wife, and what they find out is that as long as they don't stay together, they can survive. Is that human beings have to sort of spread apart individually. They can't be in each other's company because then the neurotoxins will kill them. So there's a scene at the end of the movie where they've taken refuge in this old farmhouse. And the farmhouse has the main house, and then there's like a servant's quarters somewhere else on the property. And there's an ancient speaking tube that connects the two rooms.
Yeah.
So,
Jones's house.
Right. And so it's one character is in the house and his wife is over here in the servants' quarters, and they can't physically be together. They can only communicate through this tube. And I was sort of imagining this could be a sort of a cool movie about people being alienated from each other and only being able to communicate through like telephones or the internet.
I agree with your cat. Right. And what's he wind up saying on the speaking tube? Hey, let's go out and die together.
Yeah,
stop talking on the stupid speaking tube and go out and bring the kid too so she can die.
Right, yeah. So anyway, I liked that, The Happening could have been a cool sort of movie about how people have to be alone. How once we come together, we will be extinct, so we have to like embrace being isolated from one another and communicating through these remote means. So there you go. That sort of redeemed, in a way, having to sit through that crappy movie.
Wow.
That concept. All right, that's my number two.
That's not the actual end of the movie, the end of the movie.
Well, you know what? Let's not even go into the real ending. You know what? Let's pretend I walked out after that part. And didn't see the Paris outbreak that they allude to at the ending.
You nailed me.
All right, so Dingus, what's your number two?
My number two is another great Australian film called Oasis. Wait, hold on. No, Oasis is from South Korea. My mistake. Again, this is just as much of a fail as my last one, is that I was constantly – this was I have to say, Oasis was brought to my attention by the Quarter
Oasis. Oh, Oasis. Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, Oasis. And it's a film from South Korea. And it's a really hard film to watch, but really worth watching, I think. But it's just that the characters, I was constantly frustrated with the characters and hating every one of them. In fact, one of the notes I wrote pretty deep into the movie is just, I hate everybody in this movie. And then finally, near the end of the movie, it clicked for me that the point of the movie is frustration, and the frustration of the characters is what you should be feeling as well. And so by the end of the movie, I'm not going to say I loved the movie, because I certainly did not, but I got it by the end. That the very thing that was my roadblock was sort of the point of the movie.
Kelly, have you seen Oasis?
No, it sounds good, though.
Okay. That makes me want to see it.
Yeah. You didn't see it either?
No, I did not see it.
We're both members of that film club. We haven't seen these movies.
It's in my queue, though. It's in my
mine, too, queue. Along with The Objective.
And Kelly, you named the movie that I wanted to launch as if I ever get picked for the Quarter to Three Film Club. So, yeah, that's a spoiler.
Which one? Oh.
Wyatt Earp.
Every Day?
No, the only one you've ever talked about in this 3x3.
Quiet Earth.
Oh, okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
My number two, I think you're done. And I'm almost done, is the Kiefer Sutherland
Star. Uh-oh, you know what? There's nowhere you can go from that.
I know. Well, I've got these lists have totally jumped the shark already.
I'm guessing Mirrors?
Mirrors, correct. I like the ending Mirrors.
But it didn't.
Go on.
Well, I'm sorry.
You're going to need a smaller shark for this.
But it didn't redeem the movie, though, did it? Like, you know what?
It did for me, but Put it this way, it did for me as much as whatever you said did for you.
You know, that's a good point. Yeah, I don't have any room to be bringing that up. So what, explain the ending, for folks who might not have seen it and wouldn't mind having it spoiled. First of all, it's a terrible movie, so I think it's okay to spoil it.
There's actually a good scene before it where, Amy Smart looks in a mirror and she pulls her jaw off.
Yep.
Which is kind of good. I like that. And she's naked. Which, so, if you're a jawbone fetishist, it's kind of a twofer.
And this, by the way, is Alexander Aja, who's, you know, a French horror.
I don't know anything about sports, sorry. Anyway.
So explain the ending, Kelly.
Well, as, like most American horror crappy movies, except for Paranormal Activity, stuff like The Ring, it seems to explain, there's a lot of exposition about why things are happening and why the demon possessed this person, and it's all really boring, because I think the best horror movies are sort of like, they have this dream logic, and you don't really want to know what's going on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Once a horror movie has to explain the stuff, it's no longer scary.
Yeah.
You know, you just got a monster running around the woods, and you have to, you know,
do this. Like how Tim Roth gets into the tunnel at the end of 28 Weeks Later isn't the point of that scene. Like, if you're thinking about that, the movie's not working.
Especially because he's not even in the movie.
Yeah, he is, isn't he?
I know. I was like, wow, how did he get in the tunnel?
Hang on.
Not even
what am I thinking of?
You followed Gary Oldman in there, I think.
Wait.
Hey, how'd you get in here?
Oh, Robert Carlyle. How'd you get here? By Tim Roth, I meant Robert Carlyle. Get the Australians mixed up. But anyway. What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So mirrors, there's a bunch of hoo-ha about why the demon, there's a demon, spoiler alert. It lives in a mirror, like the one in Prince of Darkness, spoiler alert. He's possessing this one girl, and there's a nun, like in The Ring. But at the end, Kiefer Sutherland beats them, I forget how, I think by shattering the mirror or something really, something scientific, like in The Quiet Earth. But then he comes out of the thing, and you see he's in the mirror world.
Yeah, it's like everything's written backwards.
And he leaves his handprint on the window, and that's like the only sign of him that exists. It's good shit.
All right. Okay.
And also Paula Patton's like wet for most of the movie. So that's good. Great film. Number two. Number one. What are we on?
Wait, hold on. I just want to bring up, this is the second time you've talked about demons and mirrors.
Yeah, I have a thing.
When was the first time?
Paranormal Activity. He talked about how demons love mirrors. Blue.
Okay.
Yeah, they do. It's all in the books. That Tom studied in theology class.
Are they by Graham Greene?
See, someone has to mention books ever in these podcasts, or we're going to lose the smart crowd.
That's right. We do read. We do read books. We don't watch TV. We read books. So that was Kelly's number two. Is that right?
I think that was about a 20-minute spiel about nothing, as opposed to.
Well, now here's the one. I'm gonna now bust this list wide open, because I'm gonna defy you guys to come up with a better movie for this list. The list being movies that you hate that suck until the very end. And this movie, this definitely applies. I could not stand this movie. I thought this movie was absolutely vile. It's a French horror film.
Them.
No. Although Them is good, but I liked Them while I was watching it. This movie is called Martyrs. And I don't think either of you have seen it.
I thought you were going to say Inside.
I thought you were going to say something I'd heard of to make it exciting.
Martyrs is pretty obscure, and I think rightfully so. I mean, it really, like I said, it's vile. I mean, it starts with the torture of a child, and there's the murder of a family, and then there's all this like scary self-mutilation, ghost girl stuff, and then there's this protracted period of just grueling torture porn. And I don't recommend the movie to anyone. And I was just like, God, what's going on here? And it had been recommended to me, and I'd heard of it. But in the process of jumping through a few different genres and becoming a few different kinds of movies, most of which are vile, the very last thing that it does redeems everything you've sat through, I feel. The twist at the ending, I just thought was brilliant. And it reaffirms there's this awesome new wave of French directors doing incredibly over-the-top stuff. like Dingus, not interiors, inside, or like Alexander Aja with High Tension and the Hills Have Eyes remake. Martyrs is definitely part and parcel of that. So the end of Martyrs, the final, it's maybe 5 minutes, redeems all this crap you have to sit through. And I hesitate to spoil it because I kind of think if you're into horror films and if you're willing to stomach just how vile the movie is, then I would kind of recommend it if you can stomach that. So you're having trouble with what, Kelly? Go ahead.
Spoiling the endings of movies. Even though I said in an email earlier, let's spoil everything, because who cares? What are they going to do?
Well, Kelly, my problem is that it's okay with me if we spoil the subject movie, but the movies in the interior of our podcast I worry about too. But once we get going, I sort of get carried away.
Well, I think we're good. We can spoil the happening because it's terrible.
Right. We're doing people a favor. So
right.
I think the difference here is now you're making me want to see Mars.
I know.
I don't want it spoiled for myself.
And you know what, Kelly? You are one of the few people to whom I would recommend it. Dingus, I don't think you should see it.
You just drew back from the brink too because I think you were thinking.
No, you could spoil it for me if it begins with the murder of a child.
Not the murder of a child, the murder of a family. Actually, but the family does have two children, so yeah, that is it's one child is tortured and then another family is murdered who has nothing to do with the family.
Yeah.
And it all ties together. I mean, the thing is you're watching, you're like, what the hell is this movie doing? This can't make any sense. This is ridiculous. And it ends up being pretty clever and having a really cool, sort of horror movie twist.
Well, let me ask this, Tom. How deep into the film does this happen that you had that reversal?
Oh, the final 5 minutes. Literally, the final. Oh. And of the final 5 minutes, I spent the first three of those minutes thinking, what? What is going on? Why? Huh? And then the final 2 minutes, it's just the very last thing that happens. I was like, oh, wow. I can't believe they went through all that to come to this point, but it makes sense.
That's amazing to me. I just racked my brain to think of a film that did that. That last couple minutes made me go, oh, all right, I get it.
Because you don't sit through them. You just walk out.
And this thing, too, I could totally imagine people like not sitting through this. You know, one of the things I was thinking of was Irreversible, the Gaspar Noé thing, which is just a great big F you to the audience for most of the movie. And it ends up with this really tender scene between Vincent Cassel and Monica Bellucci that, because of the nature of the movie, sort of makes you feel a little differently in almost in a bad way or a good way about everything you've seen. But it doesn't quite apply to this idea of a movie that you hate, that's ruined, and then that you hate and then it's redeemed in the final moments. Irreversible is a little different. But Martyrs, I feel that's definitely the case with Martyrs. There were so many times during Martyrs, I was like, why am I watching this? And I even think, the fact that I didn't, most people would leave. I can't imagine anyone putting up with what that movie puts you through.
You see, I almost totally broke the category and went for something like Irreversible or Memento, since the end of the movie is technically the beginning. So I
right.
can just say, you know, the end of Memento, the end of Memento really made it for me because I hated that movie going in, but luckily the ending was the first thing I saw.
Wait, is that your number one?
No.
That's a good one.
All right, so that's my number one, a movie that no one has seen, and that if I had my druthers, not many people would see. But Kelly, I do recommend it to you. Dingus, don't watch Martyrs.
Right, yeah, you're a parent. You don't get to see anything good anymore.
Yeah. Dingus, what's your number one movie that was terrible until the very ending when you liked it?
All right, my number one movie that was terrible until I finally understood it. Was a movie called Lars and the Real Girl.
Good Lord.
Which
is that Nicole Kidman?
It's Nicole Kidman and Tom Hanks. It's a romp. It's really... it's not.
Lars von Trier.
Lars von Trier, whose name is not Vaughn.
And he's Australian.
And he's also from South Korea. Oh. Lars and the Real Girl, because for most of that movie, I was just rolling my eyes and thinking, why is anybody putting up with anything in this town? Why don't they just either move out of the town or beat everybody up? And that at some point, very, very late in the film, I finally understood what the film was about, or at least my mind tricked me into thinking what the film was about, that it was really about the way people put up with or indulge children in the way everybody puts up with the way children are in a make-believe world. And I finally understood that everything that was going on in the office scenes was really just daycare. Because everybody had toys, and they were messing around with toys and trading around toys. And I finally understood that that's what this film was about. It was about children. It was about how we deal with children. And it was done through the lens of this adult who has this ridiculous relationship. And for some reason, and I don't know why this is, but it clicked for me, and I was able to like the movie because I realized that it wasn't about just some goofy guy with a doll.
Huh.
Hmm.
Did you see that movie, Tom?
I couldn't stand that movie. It never clicked for me.
we're not parents, and so anything with kids, Dingus is going to love.
I have a hard time watching there are perfectly good kids out there. Why not have them be in a movie about kids?
Yeah. It's like that in that movie, Kids.
Excellent argument. Thank you for making my case.
All right, but that's I did appreciate hearing your take on Lars and the Real Girl, Dingus. We've talked about that before. I didn't care for the movie at all, and I enjoy hearing.
And by the way, I don't think I'm necessarily right about my interpretation, but it enabled me to enjoy it.
You're entitled to it, even if it's crazy.
And Ryan Gosling is someone too who I'm willing to watch even in a crappy movie. That's true. You don't feel that way, Kelly Wand?
Talking about
Ryan Gosling. Yeah.
Did you see Half Nelson?
No.
Oh, good God.
Did you see the depth of my commitment to Ryan Gosling. He's in some Sandra Bullock movie that's in my Netflix queue that I really want to see, where he and Michael Pitt play like murderers or something. Do you guys know what this movie is? It's some Sandra Bullock thriller. So that's how much I like Ryan Gosling and Michael Pitt, is that I'm willing to watch a Sandra Bullock movie to see them. So
remember when you started to like Casey Affleck and then you grew a vagina?
I love Casey Affleck. What are you talking about?
Yeah, you're 2/3 of this podcast is in the Casey Affleck fan
club. That's fine. Well, that says a lot about this podcast.
Are you talking about Academy Award nominee Casey Affleck?
For what?
Wasn't he nominated for Jesse James?
Yeah, and he should have been nominated for the lead role in Assassination of Jesse James.
Yeah, Kelly Wand, Academy Award. And every time you mention Casey Affleck, I need you to preface his name with Academy Award nominee Casey Affleck.
Casey Oscar nominee Affleck. That's how I'm going to refer to him from now on.
Is he your
favorite Affleck? Oh, yeah, my number one.
Yeah, what's your number one? The movie that you hated until the ending, at which point the ending redeemed it for you.
I have the least good number one. But then we'll be done, so that's the exciting part. My number one is Birdie with
Age
and Matthew Modine.
Why do you think that's terrible?
Yeah, what?
Because I
love the ending of Birdie. The ending of Birdie.
I just have a
the ending of Birdie
against,
is famous.
Yeah, but the ending's the best part.
Can you give us the last line of Birdie, Kelly Wand? What's just the last line? You don't even have to act it. What's the last line of Birdie?
What?
Nice. Nice.
Yeah. It's Deer Hunter. Ending meets John Landis. Spoiler alert.
I don't pretend to understand that, but I think it's brilliant.
I don't know. I find Matthew Modine hard to watch for some reason because he's greasy. And so that's why I didn't like Birdie till the end. And then I realized Matthew Modine was awesome. Kind of like I didn't like Julia Roberts till Closer. And then I realized she was awesome.
But did you then see Duplicity to be cured of that?
No. I prefer to keep my dreams intact.
Birdie's a good one. Now, so explain a little bit about, like, talk about that a little bit more, Kelly Wand.
He's a Vietnam vet.
Well, why does the ending, what does the ending do for you?
The ending subverts your expectations because someone jumps off of a fire escape or building, a roof.
It's just, you think it's going to be a dark
You think it's ending. Like Christopher Walken shooting himself in Deer Hunter.
And it's instead just this cute little joke.
Yeah. And he's just sitting there, and he goes, what?
Except you can act it. It's more like, what?
I can't. Well, you said I didn't have to act it. And well, I just keep saying it.
But now try it. You know, try it with some feeling.
What?
And that was a little too annoyed, because that raised the stakes a little bit. You kind of have to throw it away. Can we do another take on that?
Well, hang on. What?
Now, here, I'm going to be Nicolas Cage, okay? Hmm. I'll feed you the line. Are you ready? Birdie!
What?
Good, good. Let's keep that one. Print it. That's a wrap.
Thank God we can edit these stupid podcasts so they don't run 3 hours.
How is my Nicolas Cage, by the way?
Oh, that's what you're doing?
I think the what should be more Edward James Olmos, personally.
Angus, okay, I'm giving you a demerit for that. No one knows what you're talking about. You've normally been pretty good, but that's minus 10 points for Dingus.
Normally he's pretty good.
Dingus has this weird, I don't understand this, there's a moment in Battlestar Galactica where Edward James Olmos asks what.
What?
Yeah, and Dingus thinks, like, it's a, for some reason, it has some significance to Dingus. I don't
know what we're talking about.
And, yeah.
Uh-huh, he watches Battlestar Galactica.
Oh, crap.
Ruined by the finale.
So, actually, he's still in, like, the first season, I think, so no BSG spoilers here.
2.5.
So, Dingus, you are responsible for next week's 3x3 topic. What are you giving us to chew on over the next week and then come back with three movies for next week's show?
All right. My 3x3 is – I actually have a title for it. It's called The Company You Keep. And, yeah, I know. Nice size, guys. All right. Your task for the week, should you choose to accept it, or even if you don't, is three movies that were ruined by the people you saw them with. So it's either it can be the group of people in the theater, it can be the date, it can be any group of people that you saw them, but that you saw them and it ruined the experience and that hopefully you watched later and it worked out for you. So as an example, as I have a very good friend who, as her first date, she went to see Blue Velvet in a theater. And for years, she could not see that film again. And eventually, she came to understand that it was a pretty good film. But so the three films that were ruined, that the experience was ruined by the people that you saw them with.
By the company that you keep.
By the company that you keep.
Okay. Okay.
Good. My list is now 2/3 done, by the way.
Right. What are you talking about?
I just wrote two things down.
Oh, yeah, I see. For next week, we'll save it for next week.
And I'm sort of tempted to preempt the temptation to say that next week's list will be three films that were made by the people you watched them with, and say we could do either. It could be either way, but I'm leaning more toward it being films that were ruined by the people you watched it with.
Oh, I want to do. Let's do both.
Okay, that's fine with me because I want the following week's list to be fresh.
Question, okay. Does the projectionist count?
It has to be someone with whom you have some sort of relationship.
All right, and so not the usher.
Well, if you have something with the usher, if he's your dealer,
right,
or whatever.
Watch it with the usher.
So movies that were either made or ruined by the company you keep. I like that. That works good. That's good. We'll have some interesting anecdotes, I hope. And now what movie are we seeing next week?
Either The Box.
No, don't. No, either. We've decided. This Kelly, you are just terrible at at whole like radio etiquette kind of stuff.
No, it makes it sound more natural.
You know what? I'm like throwing it over to Dean. You make it sound like we're making it up as we go along. We've actually decided already.
Right.
We know this.
I remember now. Yes, that is not The Box. Decision was made.
So, yeah, Men Who Stare at Goats.
Ah, yes. Men Who Stare at Goats.
So for our listeners, if you can see it next weekend, next Monday, the podcast will be up. You can listen to us talk about it, and you can tune in for our 3x3 on movies that were made or ruined by the company that you keep. So, all right. Thanks, everyone, very much, and we will see everyone in a week.
When the truth is found to be